This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Egyptian flags wave across Cairo's Tahrir Square. It's a night in Egypt at the end of a remarkable day of revolution. Tens of thousands of protesters continue to flood the area hours after Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak stepped down 18 days after pro-democracy demonstrations began. Less than 24 hours ago, President Mubarak promised he would not bow to pressure and would remain in office through an orderly transition. Today, his hand-picked Vice President Omar Suleiman went on state-run television to announce a transfer of power.
I am committed to carrying out whatever is necessary to ensure the peaceful transition of power in accordance with the stipulations of the Constitution.
As crowds in Cairo cheered the news, the leaders of many Arab neighbors across North Africa and the Middle East worried that they might be next. More about reaction across the region today and what happens next. But we begin in Egypt. NPR's Corey Flintoff joins us now from Alexandria, the second city of the country, the major port there on the Mediterranean. Corey, can you tell us what's been happening in Alexandria today?
Yes, Neil, they're not protesters anymore. They're celebrators. I'm looking out over the Corniche, which is this famous seafront boulevard that extends all along the Mediterranean in front of Alexandria here. It's about a 10-mile-long highway, and it is absolutely packed with people right now. I'm looking at a sea of waving Egyptian flags, red, white, and black. There's a breeze coming in from the Mediterranean right now, so it's extending those flags out over the heads of the crowd. There are people firing Roman candles, so you can see these sparks flying up from the crowd, and it's an absolutely jubilant scene here.
And are people reveling in the moment, but are they also worried about what happens next?
Yes, they are. And in fact, even as some people we talked to talked about their joy in this night, one woman, for instance, said tonight is a night of joy and happiness. Tomorrow is a day of work. We also talked to a few people earlier in the afternoon before the news came out, and they said that they weren't altogether happy. One man told us that he was glad he thought that Mubarak should leave, but that he believed the protesters had gotten all their demands met. And he said, what's happening now is just vandalism. Another man told us that's what is coming up for Egypt is scary days. So it's not all celebration. People are aware, you know, that there's a lot of difficulty ahead for them.
So you remind us, clearly, the regime has its supporters. Also, there are a lot of people there who worry that life will never get back to normal. The business will never resume. The economy will remain in chaos.
That's true. We talked to a lot of people in Alexandria here, which is Egypt's second largest city and its largest port by far. A lot of people here are in import-export. Their business has been absolutely devastated by this. And they know that it'll take quite a while to return.
There is also a fact we have to acknowledge. A couple of months ago, there was a terrible bombing in Alexandria as a Coptic Christian church was detonated. I think, dozens of people were killed in the explosion. I don't remember the exact number. Nevertheless, is there some concern within the Christian community that this may be turned into a nationalistic moment, a religious moment?
That's true. There is that fear. We tried to visit Coptic churches today, this afternoon, before the news broke, and we found that many of them, all the ones that we visited, were padlocked, and there was no one inside. There is concern among the Coptic community here that, you know, this could somehow turn against them. But what we're hearing from the protesters themselves is that this is a revolution of all Egyptians. And they mentioned specifically that it's not just Muslims, it's Christians as well.
Not just Muslims, but Christians as well. That's been an important part of this. And as we do address concerns about the fears of what may happen next, Corey, we can't overlook the fact that this is the most joyous day, perhaps in many thousands of years of Egyptian history.
Yes, I think that many people in the street, at least, would tell you that that's the case. One thing that's really interesting about this demonstration is that a lot of people have brought their children, very small children indeed, and I think it's all about being able to tell them someday that you were there on this momentous day in Egyptian history.
Corey Flintoff, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Neil.
NPR correspondent Corey Flintoff with us from Alexandria, the port city on the Mediterranean, the second largest city in Egypt. Joining us now from Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, is NPR correspondent Deborah Amos. Deborah, good of you to be with us this evening.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
And earlier today, we heard a report that you filed on concerns there in the Saudi capital, telling the United States, be careful what you ask for. We're not sure that you should be abandoning your ally of 30 years so quickly and so casually.
Well, the Saudi leadership and the king himself is a close personal friend of Hosni Mubarak, and was not happy that the United States was using words like now on television to abandon what he saw as a 30-year relationship. I heard from diplomats here that younger princes did understand that Mubarak had lost legitimacy in the Egyptian capital. We are beginning to see reactions from other Gulf Arab countries. The United Arab Emirates tonight came out and said that they were comfortable with the higher military council. The government of Qatar also said that they were comfortable. I spoke to a member of the Shura Council in Bahrain tonight, which is a government body, and he said there's not going to be an official statement, but they also support what's happened in Egypt. And he also said that there was a big demonstration that came out in front of the Egyptian embassy in Bahrain. So I think across the Middle East, certainly on the street, there has been amazing celebrations, not in the Saudi leadership, but certainly on the streets here.
And that's a question that the Saudi leadership has to worry about. Will the people in Saudi Arabia see this as an example?
Neil, when you come to a country like this, you know, you tend to speak to the English speakers, the 20% of the country that are the liberals. And I can tell you, on that score, there is great celebration among them. Many of them knew some of the organizers. There is a community of social media activists in Saudi Arabia. They went to conferences. They met the head of Google in Egypt. They knew them by name. And when I called a young man who was working on a web startup, he said, "We won." Because he saw them as his team. And he was very excited. He's been watching moment by moment Al Jazeera, reading all the Twitter feeds that are coming out of Egypt, you know, retweeting. And the Saudis have been doing that since Tunisia, keeping the story going, you know, feeling that they were part of it. A human rights activist said that he got hundreds of SMS texts tonight, somebody even asking if maybe this is the time to start a political party in Saudi Arabia. These are revolutionary words in a kingdom that bans political activity. So Egypt has changed people here a lot in that, you know, 20% of the liberal population.
20% of the liberal population, as you say, it's difficult to understand necessarily what's going on with the rest of the population. But we were talking earlier, one change that cannot be denied. All of these events are being played out in front of their eyes and ears. They know what's going on in Cairo.
Well, I talked to a columnist the other day, and he said, look, it used to be that when there was a revolution in Egypt, only the elites knew. Now it's in your bedroom. It's on every device you have on in your house. Saudis are not known for watching the news. They don't, because most of the decisions are made for them at the very top. But I talked to so many Saudis who said, we all have on the television, and it's usually not Al Jazeera. They watch Al Arabiya, which is the Saudi-supported television station, the competitor to Al Arabiya, but they held back on their coverage. They, in some ways, kind of followed the Saudi leadership. So many Saudis were watching Al Jazeera and following it moment by moment. There were many people I would talk to. I could book an interview at about 9 o'clock, but they wanted to be out by 10 because they wanted to go home and watch television. People were not getting a whole lot of work done in the last couple of weeks because they were so obsessed by the story.
Saudi Arabia, obviously one of the centers of the Arab and Islamic world, but Egypt, is Egypt looked upon as another?
Well, yes, it is Saudi Arabia's closest ally. The two intelligence services are closely linked. They see eye to eye on standing up against Iran, on how to deal with Hezbollah, the militant Shiite organization in Lebanon. And so this, in some ways, is a blow to Saudi Arabia. And I think there's another thing that must be on their mind, that Egypt, for a while now, is going to be out of the game. They are going to be very focused on domestic issues. And that does put some pressure on Saudi Arabia to step up its international and regional role as a power here. It is not what they do. It's not what they do comfortably. But with Egypt so preoccupied with what's happening domestically, I think there will be some pressure on Saudi Arabia to take a bigger, more public role. Let's wait and see if the Saudi leadership does come out with some support for the higher military council. There is also a great deal of relations between Saudis just personally. A million Saudis live in Saudi Arabia. A million Saudis live in Egypt. And a million Egyptians work in Saudi Arabia. So there are these personal connections between the two countries.
And would Saudi Arabia, the world's largest oil exporter, doing rather better as oil prices increase over the past several months, would Saudi Arabia be willing to consider a banker's role with the new regime in Egypt, should that be necessary?
Well, I have been told that they are a bit of a banker for the Jordanians, who are also under challenge, that government. And, you know, the Saudis have reversed cuts on subsidies. That's going to cost them. The Jordanians have doubled their national debt in the last 10 years. They really can't afford that kind of policy for long. I think that many Egyptians are certainly asking, well, wait a minute, how is it that a president of a relatively poor country walks away with somewhere between $12 and $80 billion? So somewhere there is money. Whether the Saudis will bankroll Egypt to keep it stable, I think we have to wait and see. Certainly, Saudi Arabia is Egypt's largest trading partner. There's $10 billion of investment in Egypt, real estate, banks, touring companies. Saudis go to Egypt on their vacations. In fact, this is a school holiday here, and they're all flocking to Dubai because they can't go to Cairo.
Deborah Amos, NPR correspondent with us from Riyadh. Thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
We did hear earlier today from some Swiss authorities that some bank accounts of some senior Egyptians were frozen. We'll have to remain to be seen how much that has affected those billions reported to be taken away by Hosni Mubarak and whether that will materialize into anything. In any case, stay with us for continuing special coverage. We're going to be talking about the events in Cairo and how they reverberate through the Middle East and around the world. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and this is NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With me in the studio are NPR Senior Foreign Affairs Editor Lauren Jenkins and Jackie Northam, NPR Foreign Affairs Correspondent. We're expecting President Obama to be speaking to the situation in Egypt at the top of this hour. Otherwise, in about 40 minutes' time, we'll take you live to the White House when that happens. In the meantime, Jackie Northam, the United States has been obviously monitoring the situation very carefully. It's been taken by surprise on several points. But nevertheless, as you look ahead to what the president has to say today, he's going to be trying to outline, put American foreign policy and the United States in alignment with what's happened in Egypt today.
Certainly, and that is what he has been trying to do over the past couple of weeks, as you suggest. I think one of the concerns for the administration is there are just a lot of unknowns at this point. It's fairly clear now that the military will run affairs at this point. Field Marshal Tantawi came out and said that. But after that, it's they don't know how this thing is going to shape out. In other words, will the military allow something like the Muslim Brotherhood to take part in any sort of political process? Now, how fast will the reforms come into place? Just all those sort of unknowns that they have to deal with.
And Lauren Jenkins, as the administration looks out towards its interests in the region, well, the rest of the region is looking to the United States as well for signals as to what it's going to do. As we heard from Deborah Amos, concern from senior parts of the Saudi leadership in any case about the reliability of Washington at this point.
Absolutely. I think there are a lot of questions being asked. A lot of regimes, dictatorships, most of them are monarchies, have been used to having U.S. support. That the bargain was stability over democracy and the unpredictableness of democracy. All of a sudden, that's not so sure. We're going to be just supporting authoritarian governments.
It's unclear the United States moved quickly enough to reaffirm to the demonstrators that the United States was on their side. Nevertheless, it's clear that the leadership in Egypt got the message. The United States was saying it's time to go now.
And I think it's been noticed by everybody, and that's going to have an effect.
And Jackie Northam, as you look out towards the effect across the region, it's not just Egypt, of course. It's not just Saudi Arabia. We heard from Deborah Amos there. The situation with the Palestinians and Israel has to be on everybody's mind. And at the top of that, the Camp David peace accords, the peace treaty that has kept Egypt out of the anti-Israeli coalition, at least militarily, for three decades now.
Right, certainly. And that, again, that's been sort of like a central pillar of Israel's national security doctrine for many years now. And it's created some sort of stability in the minds of Israel that they do have this partner in a very, very turbulent region otherwise. But that's not a given anymore. We don't know what's going to happen with that. Certainly, you know, anything could happen. And you were talking about, you know, the Palestinians. Already Hamas has come out and said it, you know, applauds Mubarak's resignation and applauds that the military has taken over, and it's already calling for an end to the blockade of Gaza. So all these pieces that were a sure deal over the past couple of decades, all of a sudden they don't exist. They're up for grabs right now. Again, nobody knows.
And whoever's in charge in Egypt, again, we don't know who's in charge in Egypt right now and who will be in a few weeks or a few months or certainly this time next year. But in any case, even if they support the peace treaty with Israel, it's almost certain the policy towards Gaza is likely to change.
Oh, yes, absolutely, towards Gaza is going to change. And also, you know, just the way that the whole U.S. has been handling this situation as well. And that could be, and what I mean by that is that the U.S. could come in and now say, look, maybe now put some pressure on Israel. Maybe now is the time to push, you know, for peace talks again, to get these going in that. So even, you know, this does offer the U.S. sort of a window of opportunity now, because it's got, things have just changed. The whole dynamics in the region have changed.
Lauren Jenkins, the United States has had relatively little leverage or influence with the leadership in Israel these past couple of years since President Obama came to power. And is that likely to change as Israel looks out on a world where it has one friend, the United States?
Well, one would think it might change, but the way the government in Israel has been acting in the last years, I'm not sure. They're very much determined to do it their way, and they don't care what anyone else really has said, including the United States. They've stiffed U.S. suggestions right down the line. The so-called peace process hasn't really been functioning for, you know, at least a year, if not longer. Mostly Israel feels they don't need it. They don't need to make peace with the Palestinians because the Palestinians haven't been that much of a threat to them recently. I think the important thing to remember is that Camp David for Israel was key because it neutralized the one Arab power on its borders that could really threaten it and overrun it. They almost did in 73. It was a real danger to Israel. And the beauty of Camp David from them is that they no longer had to look at that border. They could look at Syria. They could look elsewhere. They could deal with the Palestinians or Lebanon. The idea that it possibly, depending on what regime emerges, they might not have as friendly an Egyptian power on their border. And that has to change the whole equation of how Israel thinks strategically.
Strategically at this moment, not a tactical concern.
No.
The Egyptian army at the moment is
no
threat to Israel.
Nevertheless,
if the situation in Gaza changes, the Egyptian government has been complicit with the Israeli blockade. Obviously, a lot of materials getting through maybe with a wink and a nod through tunnels, but that's quite different from open borders with Egypt and supplies flowing freely into Gaza. How is Israel likely to react to that?
Well, one of the things that's being bandied about in some Israeli circles is they may have to reinvade Gaza and occupy it again if they can't trust the Egyptians to help them with their blockade. That's an object of discussion right now in Israel, that if it really changes, if that border opens up between Gaza and Egypt, the Israelis won't be happy. They may decide to go back in and reoccupy it to try and control it.
And Jackie Northam, I wanted to step back for just a moment as we go back from Egypt and try to look at this across the region. We've talked some about Israel and Palestine, some about Saudi Arabia. Your experience in Afghanistan and elsewhere in the region, how are they going to be reacting to these events in Cairo to see an Islamic Arab society rise up and throw off people that, well, they've had not dissimilar circumstances in some places.
Right. It's not just an Islamic Republic. I mean, it's Egypt, which was a powerhouse. Nobody ever thought that it would fall this fast or that Mubarak would fall this fast. It's a little uncertain what's, I mean, there's too much going on in Afghanistan. People are just trying to get by. I don't think they're going to rise up at this point. But, you know, as Lauren has probably said throughout this thing, is that, you know, they're just all these other states. I think people are watching and all these other nations, what will happen there? And that will be the bellwether of what will happen in other areas. But we haven't seen it yet today. We've seen small protests. If you look at something like Jordan, if you look at something like Yemen and that type of thing, it's hard to say. But those governments in a lot of these nations where they are worried have been pretty quick to sort of, you know, create better subsidies again for the people, increase, you know, government wages all of a sudden and that sort of thing. So they've been quick to sort of tamp down any sort of dissent. But, you know, in the scope of history, this might just be a starting point for something else. But again, these are such early days right now. We don't know.
Scope of history, what exactly it's going to mean, Lauren Jenkins, we don't know, as Jackie Northam just pointed out. Yet we do know, I think, one thing. The Middle East not going to be the same anymore.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a tectonic shift of Middle East affairs and history. There's a whole new power that's been revealed, that the power of people actually matters, even in countries that are tightly run and deeply repressed.
Earlier today, NPR's Robert Siegel spoke with Nobel Prize laureate Mohammed al-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, who said the army will have the full support of the people.
I was assured that the army would reach out to the Egyptian society, and we have always had confidence in that the army will come when Egypt in a crisis, and they have come absolutely at the right moment.
Mohammed al-Baradei wrote an op-ed in today's New York Times, which suggested the creation of a wise men's council to, well, help the army oversee a period of transition after Mr. Mubarak leaves. It was prescient in at least that regard. Mr. Mubarak, of course, left Cairo earlier today for the presidential palace at Sharm el-Sheikh and has turned over all his responsibilities of government. The country is now being run by an army council. But there is another organized factor in the country. That's the Muslim Brotherhood. The head of the Muslim Brotherhood, Issam al-Aryan, clearly welcomed the news of Mubarak's resignation. And earlier today, he says he expects the army to hand over power.
The army promised, committed to meet with the demands of the people. There is a list of demands I think the army must be committed to. Thank you very much.
The list of demands that the people have put to the army include the end of the rule of emergency law, the end of the regime, throwing out the constitution, suspending a parliament which they consider to be elected under illegitimate circumstances, basically starting from scratch. We heard earlier today also from an army spokesman who said that the army will be moving quickly toward democratic elections, and we heard some speculation that, in fact, those elections may be accelerated rather ahead of the schedule, which called for them to be held in September. That was under the previous arrangement. Well, at this point, all the previous arrangements are, well, just so much paper, and they're all in waste paper baskets. Daniel Kurtzer is a former U.S. ambassador to both Egypt and Israel, currently a professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Joins us now from studio at Princeton, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Thanks, Neil.
And as you look at the situation in Egypt and the way ahead, the army clearly in control now. Do you think the army is going to want to stay in control?
Well, you know, there's two definitions of power in Egypt, and I think we need to distinguish between them. The army, since 1952, has been the legitimizing force within society. It's been the arbiter of ultimate power. It has sat beneath or behind the seat of power, but has not really wanted to exercise political control on a day-to-day basis. I think what the demonstrators are expecting is that the army will create political space within which a kind of parliamentary democracy can take hold, allowing associations and parties and elections and so forth. But I would not expect that the army will, under any circumstances, yield the ultimate power that they hold of determining the future orientation of the country.
The Army Council, the military council, which now says it's in charge. These are the paladins of the Mubarak regime. These are the senior officers who have propped him up in power. Might there be less senior officers who may be willing to say at this moment, gentlemen, your time also has passed?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's why we've seen the end of one chapter, but this is a long book. That council that we saw on television that's issuing communiques is totally the creation of Hosni Mubarak. Every one of those generals received his promotion because of Mubarak's grace. So there will be a period of time in the weeks and months ahead when that council itself will come under scrutiny. Are they really advancing the interests of the demonstrators who effected Mubarak's departure? Or are they protecting their own interests and the interests of the army as a corporate entity within society?
And if junior officers decide to take action, well, at that point, nobody knows what could happen.
Oh, sure. If the army fragments in any way, and in fact, there are really three armies. There's the senior officer corps, the kind of middle grade officers, and the conscripts. If that army loses its coherence, then all bets are off. Until now, I think the army has done a really very good job in maintaining solidarity, largely by virtue of the fact that the decision was made that they were not going to carry out any orders to fire on the people. The challenges ahead, though, are very different. They're not going to involve bullets, but they involve ballots. And here's where there may be a real difference of view between senior officers who want to hold on to what they've got, as opposed to the more junior officers or even the conscripts who do want to see fundamental change.
The first challenge, perhaps, to military authority may be come from Tahrir Square. How long will those demonstrators stay if the army says, all right, we need to get back to business as usual. We need to get back to, of course, working on transition, but you people need to go home.
Oh, I think that's the message that the demonstrators are going to hear once they finish their partying and expressing their jubilation tonight. We saw it yesterday with the attempt by the army to choreograph a more graceful exit by Mubarak. You remember right after Mubarak spoke, Omar Suleiman, the vice president, got on television and said, okay, time to go home. The army was hoping that they had found a point at which the demonstrators would be satisfied. They clearly weren't. But given the reaction we've seen in Tahrir Square, I think it's safe to say that the army will now put the word out that, business in the country has got to get back to normal. And at that point, the reform process will start. I would suggest, Neil, that there's one very important milestone we can watch for. If, in fact, the demonstrations end, the army will be expected to lift the emergency laws immediately. If they do, we've gotten off to a good start. If they don't, the demonstrators are going to wonder whether they got fooled.
And also, would you look for the army to either explicitly or implicitly put forward its candidate in the upcoming presidential elections?
I don't think they're going to be as heavy-handed as putting forward their own candidate. There have been some polls in the last few days that suggest it's a kind of wide-open view of the people in the square. With Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister, doing far better than anyone else. So I think the army is going to be cautious about advancing the prospects of one of its own, but they'll also be cautious to vet whoever the candidates are to make sure that the possible next president is not too far afield from their own interests.
Mentioned also that you were previously ambassador to Israel as well. They have to be watching this with considerable interest and considerable nervousness.
Sure. And they have legitimate reasons to be concerned, not because of what's happening in Egypt only, but because a couple weeks ago, Hezbollah manipulated and maneuvered its way to become the puppet master of the Lebanese government. Hamas is still controlling Gaza. There are demonstrations in Jordan. And I think Israel is concerned that the stability of the treaty remain intact. I would differ with something was said a few minutes ago. There's no consideration in Israel whatsoever of reoccupying Gaza. They're certainly concerned if the Hamas begins to break the ceasefire that exists and rockets begin to rain down, and I wouldn't rule out a military action. But the last thing anybody in Israel wants is a reoccupation of an area that was occupied since 1967 without any success whatsoever.
Is there going to be some recrimination in Israel, though, to say, wait a minute, in retrospect, we had a moment, not merely a moment, we had 3 decades of a peace agreement with Egypt, the major military factor on the Arab side, 30 years in which we could have reached an accommodation with the Palestinians, and we have failed to take advantage of that opportunity.
Oh, I actually hope so. I don't know if it will happen, but I do hope that there's a real debate that takes place as to whether or not a moment was missed, or in fact many moments were missed. And I think that debate, should it take shape, will take 2 forms. One is, could something have been locked in with the Palestinians years ago when Egypt would have provided a great amount of support and sustenance for a treaty between Israel and Palestine? But second is the debate that's taken place in Israel this past week. Part of the Israeli system has looked askance at Tahrir Square and has said, you know, we're very comfortable with the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. And I think the Israelis are going to do some soul searching. Already Nathan Sharansky, the former Soviet dissident, former Israeli minister, has said that why won't Israel take a chance and suggest that democracy can actually be helpful in its neighboring countries. So there's 2 very different debates that are going to take place in Israel, and the sooner the better, I would think.
Ambassador Kurtzer, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Neil.
Daniel Kurtzer, former ambassador to Israel and to Egypt and professor at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, spoke to us from a studio on the campus there. We're expecting President Obama to address the situation in Egypt in about 20 minutes' time. Stay tuned for that. When he's ready, we'll take you to the White House live. In the meantime, we're going to continue with Senior Foreign Affairs Editor Lauren Jenkins and with Jackie Northam, NPR Foreign Affairs Correspondent. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and we're expecting the President of the United States to be addressing the situation as it's developed today in Egypt in about 20 minutes' time. We'll take you live to the White House there when that happens. With me here in the studio is NPR Senior Foreign Affairs Editor Lauren Jenkins. In a moment, we're also going to be talking with Shibley Telhami from American University, Maryland University, excuse me, but previously from American University. In the meantime, though, we're going to go to Shadi Hamid, director of the research at Brookings Doha Center. He's on with us from Tahrir Square in Cairo, the epicenter of events, not just today, but the past 2.5 weeks. Shahid Hamadi, congratulations. What's it like there?
Yeah, hi. How are you? So it's just incredible. They're just beeping everywhere, cheering. I just overheard someone say Egyptians haven't been this happy in 30 years. That sounds about right to me. I mean, words can't really describe what's going on here, just the jubilation. I mean, that said, I think that the difficult work really starts tomorrow. A military coup is not the same thing as democracy. So we're still not where the protesters want to be in terms of really fulfilling their demands of real substantive democracy.
We note that, and we've been talking about concerns over the future, but can you describe the scene there for us? Are people cheering, waving flags, setting off fireworks?
You know, the best way to describe it, it's just a big, giant party everywhere in Cairo that I've been to the last couple hours. People are in the streets. They're dancing, clapping. Just people are happy, and they're out there expressing it.
And is this a party likely to last the night through?
Yeah, it seems like it. It seems like it, yeah.
The first question that we've heard the military may face is, all right, demonstrators, you've succeeded. Mr. Mubarak is now gone. Let's all go home and get back to work, and we'll go on to the transition from there.
Well, that's a big question now. What happens next? Will people still stay in Tahrir Square? And if they do, what exactly will they be protesting? What will their demands be? We have no idea what the military really has in mind now in terms of how they want to oversee this transition. And again, the military is not a pro-democracy organization. They might become one in the coming months, but we'll have to wait and see. I think the protesters starting tomorrow, and Egyptians more generally, are going to really have to think seriously about how to take this to the next level and keep the momentum and continue putting pressure on, in this case, Egypt's new leaders to make sure that reform actually goes through.
The demonstrators have achieved the not inconsiderable feat of maintaining and building momentum, but against something. Now, do they have to be for something? And, well, at that point, momentum becomes more difficult, does it not?
Yes, yes. President Mubarak provided a rallying point for the opposition. As much as people could disagree on any number of things, they could agree that they wanted Mubarak to go. But now that he's gone, it's less clear now what the main demands are going to be. And this is where we're likely to see divisions within the opposition regarding how best to proceed. And Egypt has a notoriously fractious opposition, and I think we'll really start to see, potentially more evidence of that in the coming months.
That opposition includes, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood, said to be the best organized, not necessarily the most popular, but the best organized.
Yes, yes. They are the most popular. They are by far the largest opposition force in Egypt. No one really comes close. So they have a role to play here. Up until now, they've tried to stay behind the scenes in the background. They are aware that a more visible role for them would frighten the international community. So that's their strategy has been one of, wait and see up until now. That said, there's a vacuum, I think, now in Egypt. People are looking for leadership. So the question is, will the Brotherhood take on, a more influential role? If they don't, people will look for alternatives. There aren't very clear alternatives just yet.
And finally, is any of the people that we've been hearing about in terms of the opposition, the leaders there in Tahrir Square, Mohamed El-Baradei, of course, the Nobel laureate, Amr Moussa, the former foreign minister, are any of them emerging as credible leaders?
I think Amr Moussa has a lot of potential. He's popular in Egypt. He has name recognition. There was actually a song about him, a few years back called I Love Amr Moussa, which was really popular. So he has that, but he doesn't have an organization. He doesn't have, he doesn't have a structure that can really support him in Egypt. He'd have to build that more or less from scratch. As for Mohamed El-Baradei, he's been really a massive disappointment, I think, to a lot of Egyptians. I think the last 2 weeks were his moment to rise and show himself to be a true inspirational leader, but he seems to, he did not rise to the occasion. And the big question on a lot of people's minds is the last few days was, where is Mohamed El-Baradei? Why aren't we seeing him? Why isn't he trying to play a leadership role here? So, those are the two major figures. And beyond that, there's some, smaller liberal and leftist groups that have some following. But again, the hope is if Egypt opens up that some of these parties will have a chance to organize and get their word out and build support.
Well, Shadi Hamid, we'll let you get back to the party. We appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center, with us from Tahrir Square. Of course, if you're just joining us, the president of Egypt for the past 30 years, Hosni Mubarak, left Cairo today for the last time as president. He's relocated to Sharm el-Sheikh, a presidential retreat that he's, retreated to, and he's not expected ever to return to power. There is some concern about the amount of money he may have left the capital with, and there's Swiss authorities say some accounts have been frozen. Other accounts say billions have left Cairo with former President Mubarak. We'll have to wait to see on that. And again, we're waiting for the president of the United States to speak at 3 o'clock Eastern time. But let's bring a couple of other voices into the conversation. Shibli Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He's kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you with us today.
Pleasure.
And also with us is Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, author of The Much Too Promised Land, an advisor to 6 secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations, with us from the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Aaron David Miller, good of you to be with us today.
Pleasure, Neil.
And one of the things that we've been looking ahead to is how this affects the Arab-Israeli situation and the prospect for an agreement in the Middle East. Clearly, Shibli Talhami, things have to be on hold right now, right?
No question. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is that the negotiations were on hold anyway. They were not making a lot of progress. But right now, everyone is going to wait to assess the picture. This is a major strategic shift. It is going to have consequences for every country and every country's foreign policy. And even if there isn't significant change internally in many of the Arab countries, every Arab country is going to be very sensitive to its public opinion. And that public opinion in every friendly country, including ones that have a good relationship with Israel, such as Jordan, which has a peace treaty, that public opinion is very angry with Israel and has not been supportive of the sort of actions the governments have been doing. And they have not been supportive of the government's coordination with the Israelis. So it does put pressure on that. It also puts a lot of pressure on Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who had less had been under pressure internally, the WikiLeaks, the Al Jazeera leaks, actually, on the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations had put further pressure on him. His biggest allies have been in trouble. Hosni Mubarak, arguably, was his biggest ally in the Arab world, is gone. And Saad Hariri, another ally, was the prime minister of Lebanon, lost his job. He doesn't have control over Gaza. It's a very difficult situation. The Israelis are assessing where they are. But I want to say one thing on that. Typically, when something like this happens, meaning something huge, and this is probably bigger than Arab-Israeli wars in terms of its potential consequences for the region, in terms of its potential consequences for foreign policy, everyone is going to be reassessing, but American foreign policy is going to be reassessing. And when that happens, Israelis, as happened after 9/11, first and foremost, worry about the consequences for the relationship with the U.S. That is the top, absolute top strategic priority over anything to do with the region. They have to make sure that they protect that. They know there will be an American evaluation. They know there will be a narrative now that come out of interpreting these events, what they mean, where the U.S. should go from here. They want to make sure that that comes on their side because they worry about the consequences of that. They're not going to be in any mood to do something pertaining to peace. But if you look at the big picture, Egypt had been taken for granted for such a long time that when the Arabs put a comprehensive peace plan on the table, Egypt was taken for granted. The Israelis were not as attracted to it. If you have a comprehensive peace plan now with Egypt revalidating its treaty, it's going to mean so much more to the Israelis. It discounts the possibility of a bilateral agreement with the Palestinians. It increases the chance of a comprehensive peace deal down the road.
But that may take some time. Aaron David Miller, the next meeting of the Arab League should be pretty interesting.
I think so. I mean, I take Shibli's point that transformative change produces opportunity. After all, most of the breakthroughs in this conflict have occurred as a consequence of transformative change. October 73 paved the way for disengagement agreements. Sadat's trip to Jerusalem for Egyptian-Israeli peace. First Persian Gulf War paved the way for Madrid. The problem here is that there are so many moving parts to this equation, and the impact in the Arab world right now is so uncertain that I suspect as people sort through this, they're going to be in a very withholding mood. The political space that has been available for Israelis and Americans to operate in this region is about to contract substantially. And I'm not entirely persuaded yet. I mean, I think we're going to have to watch how this plays out, whether or not that space is going to broaden in a way that would frankly allow for the kind of comprehensive approach to peacemaking that that Shibli has identified. The notion, clearly, of an Israeli-Palestinian peace chances were slim to none even before this occurred. So you could argue that with this kind of transformation, assuming everything breaks right, assuming Egyptian democracy goes the way we want it to go, to quote Ben Franklin when the young woman asked him apocryphally after that hot summer of 1787, what kind of government
have you given
America
us?
Would have. He said, a republic if you can keep it. We're a long way from putting in the bank the notion that all of these political changes are going to go smoothly. And in the Middle East, amidst great uncertainty, people don't take risks, not unless the prospects of pain and gain are so profoundly motivating that it impels them to do so. The Israelis, I think, they worry for a living anyway, quite rightly, given the dark dimension of Jewish history and their own security predicament. They're going to be reassessing constantly. Will the new Egyptian government be as supportive as Mubarak had been on Gaza? Will they be as supportive of our interests in containing Iran? Will they continue to cooperate with us, with the Brotherhood more active on issues of counterterrorism and the pursuit of Islamic radicals? There are a range of issues here, and I think it's way too early to be laying the predicate for even more ambitious kinds of peacemaking when the ones of even a more moderate character have run into so much trouble.
Lauren Jenkins, it's clear that we shouldn't get too far ahead. It's unclear what's going to shake out in Cairo. And one thing we do know, however, it is going to be different, profoundly different from things we have seen over the past 30 years.
I think so. I think the issue that we all are sitting here thinking about is just how different and what directions it's going to take. This is a whole new chapter in Middle East history. We just don't know. I learned as a reporter in the Middle East a long time ago, never be predictive. Let something happen, and then you can analyze it. But you start getting ahead of yourself, it's going to go a different way. I mean, it's a great unknown we're entering into.
Shibli Tilhami, I wonder, is there one thing that you're looking for to see that might give you a tip about how things may go in Egypt in the next few days?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you can't disconnect it from everything else in the Arab world. I mean, yes, this is an Egyptian event, but frankly, this is an Arab event. This is a Middle East event. I imagine that every Arab in every Arab country, whether it's Saudi Arabia, Morocco, or Lebanon, is as proud as Egyptians are today of this moment. And so in that sense, the observation isn't going to be just in Egypt, because if there's validation outside, if you're going to have major celebration of this, a lot of people were asking the question, where are the rest of the Arabs in the past few weeks? There were some, but not on the scale that some people may have anticipated. They were all glued to TV, the assumption was. Well, now it happened. The big story is there. What will happen? First thing is, obviously, there are a lot of leaders around who are fearful for themselves, are hoping that things are going to go badly in Egypt, meaning we're going to have anarchy. Let's remember, you know, after the Iraq War, that the public fear of what came after the Iraq War in 2003, all the horrors and the anarchy, enabled a lot of leaders to say, would you rather be in Amman or would you rather be in Baghdad, would you rather be in Cairo or Baghdad? The choice was clear. Mm. And you don't want to be in a situation where, do you want to be in Riyadh or do you want to be in Cairo, where the answer is one direction. And I think there are a lot of people, we have to worry, first of all, about stability. Stability is important. And number two, we should have early indications now that the army is in charge of whether or not they're going to follow through by putting together a more comprehensive and encompassing government to begin with, and whether, in fact, they will remove the emergency laws and open up the freedom of the press. I think those are the first indications that we're going to have as to what direction we're going to be following.
And Aaron David Miller, for decades now, Hosni Mubarak has been saying, if we allow those kinds of reforms, if we allow our society to open up, that point you're going to get, well, it's not going to be me, it's going to be chaos, it's going to be the Muslim Brotherhood. After me, après moi le déluge. That's been essentially one of his arguments.
Yeah, and I think it really gets to the point of the new contract between the military and the civilian political establishment. The reality is Egypt has been a Praetorian state, and it is now. The army figures prominently not just in the national security policies of this country, but clearly in its politics. All of its presidents have worn a uniform, and also in the economy. And the real question to me, it seems, and I don't doubt the power on the streets, after what we've seen in the last 2.5 weeks, the notion that a military would even dare consider opposing this seems unlikely to me. But the reality is a new relationship is going to have to be negotiated between a military that enjoys extraordinary privilege and power, owns farms, industry, businesses, doesn't pay taxes, has tremendous privilege in the society, and a political civilian establishment that is divided and still inchoate may have the sympathies of the public as well as the support of the international community. But in the end, it's going to be about governance and effective governance. And this tick-tock between the new sort of relationship between these two power centers, if you can even talk about them as such, I think is going to be a telling testament on how the evolution of Egypt's experiment, and it is an experiment, at least in its modern incarnation with democracy, fares.
Aaron David Miller, thanks very much for your time today.
Pleasure.
Aaron David Miller, a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, author most recently of The Much Too Promised Land. Our thanks as well to Shibley Telhami. Shibley Telhami is the Anwar Sadat Professor for Peace and Development at the University of Maryland and was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. We're expecting President Obama to make remarks from the White House shortly. Stay tuned to NPR News for coverage of that and for the latest from Egypt and Cairo on a day that history will not forget. Anwar Sadat, then Hosni Mubarak, the progression of Egypt's leaders who have left office one way or another continues. Something new is happening in the Middle East. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to live coverage from NPR News.